DC.
Comics.
Incredible. Action. Astonishing. Adventure. The coolest heroes.
Heroes.
The bravest heroines.
Heroines.
And the most outrageous villains.
Brutal for TV.
In the universe. DC Comics. Read 'em and love 'em.
Hello and welcome to another episode of FW Presents, the anthology show for the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and 2020 is the 85th anniversary of DC Comics. It all began in 1935 with the publication of New Fun Comics No. 1, which is the first all-new comic book ever printed. To that point, comic books, the whole notion of comic books, were that they were going to be reprinting newspaper material, but that idea, a new comic book, new material, was the creation of one man, Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson. Without him, there would be no DC Comics as we know it. There might even be comics as we know it. And so DC Comics commemorated that this year with the publication of New Fun Comics No. 1, the famous first edition reprint. But there was another celebration of the life of Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson that we're here to talk about, namely the book DC Comics Before Superman, Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson's pulp comics. This book is an extensive history of the life of Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson, plus the early days of DC Comics and how it all got started. And the book is written by my guest, Nikki Wheeler Nicholson, the granddaughter of Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson. So Nikki is here with me, and we are going to talk about this extraordinary book that I think is a must-read for any DC Comics fan or comic book historian or anything like that. It is a really fun read, and I'm very excited to talk to Nikki about it. Before we get to Nikki, though, we have to thank our sponsor for this episode of FW Presents. This episode is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping of $40 or more. So two of the deals you can find on InStockTrades.com right now is the aforementioned New Fun Comics Famous First Edition. You can get that book over on InStockTrades. It's in glorious treasury format. You know, you all know how much I love that. In 10x15 hardcover, this book collects the original New Fun Comics No. 1 exactly as it appeared in 1935. Normal price is $19.99. In-stock trades price is only $11.59. That is 42% off. It is a steal. If you go back and listen to that episode of Treasury Cast No. 47 that I did with Chuck Coletta, we went on and on about what a beautiful collection this book is, and it truly is. Aside from just the material found to be in the comic book, there are several essays, one by Nikki herself, another one by Roy Thomas, one by Jerry Bales, talking about the history of the Treasury format, talking about the Major himself, talking about where DC was in 1935, plus extensive bios of the creators involved. This is such a handsome edition. I think it, to me, is a must-own for anyone who appreciates comic book history, not just those of you that are Treasury fans, although you should all be Treasury fans. And the other book I wanted to mention is Art of the Pulps, an illustrated history hardcover written by Douglas Ellis, published by IDW. This is a collection of the history of the pulps, but mostly focusing on the art of the pulps. Anyone who's ever looked at a pulp cover from the 20s or the 30s or the 40s knows some of the most gorgeous artwork can be found on these pulps. And this book collects these graphics. And I love all these kinds of art books featuring pop culture excavations of things like that. And so this book looks absolutely fantastic. The normal price for Art of the Pulps is $49.99. In-stock trades price is $34.99. You save 30%. So you can get both these books over on InStockTrades.com. So for these and all the other trade paperback needs, visit InStockTrades.com, and we thank them for their support. We also have to mention that the Fire and Water Podcast Network is supported on Patreon. You can support us over there at patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name-checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to David S. Gutierrez and Gord Tolton for their support of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. And of course, you can find all the back episodes of FW Presents on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. And of course, we're always talking various topics, including this book over on our Twitter page, which is FW Podcast. So, all right, that is going to do it for my plugging and my intros here. We're going to run a couple of podcast promos. And when we come back, I'm going to be joined by Nikki Wheeler Nicholson to talk about her book, DC Comics Before Superman, Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson's Pulp Comics. Stay tuned.
Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast, a new monthly show chronicling the adventures of the JLI era by Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis. We'll be going issue by issue, in release order, tackling the core Justice League title, Justice League Europe, and the quarterly book. Along the way, we'll take time out for special episodes covering various spin-offs, cartoon appearances, the infamous TV pilot, and much more. So join me in an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we celebrate your favorite JLI members, such as
Martian Manhunter,
Batman,
Dr. Fate,
Black Canary,
Fire,
Ice,
Maxwell Lord,
Oberon,
Captain Marvel,
Rocket Red,
Captain Atom,
Mr. Miracle,
Guy Gardner,
Booster Gold,
Blue Beetle,
Nort, and many, many more. Justice League International, Blahaha Podcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Want to make something of it?
It's midnight, the podcasting hour. From fetid swamps to creepy castles, the podcasting hour is your home for horror on the Fire and Water Network. Join me, PJ Frightful, on this quarterly anthology podcast that gazes into the mysterious and terrifying shadows of DC Comics. The moon is full and the bell tolls for midnight, the podcasting hour.
So hi everybody, we're back, and as promised, I'm here with the author of DC Comics Before Superman, Nikki Wheeler-Nicholson. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm really thrilled to talk to you. As I said in the intro, I loved this book. I was thoroughly entertained, and I learned so much about it, so I am just thrilled to be able to get to talk to you about this, and I have so many things I want to ask you about, we'll try and get it all in as in the time we have. Let me just start off, like, the family lore of this. I mean, did you grow up with this? Was this something that was throughout your family's history of like, oh, yes, your grandfather basically created DC Comics. Was this something that you lived with from the very beginning?
Yes, but in a particular way, because my parents were divorced when I was very young, and I never knew my father until I was an adult. And I first met my father 41 years ago.
Wow.
But my mother lived with the Major and Ilsa in Great Neck, New York. She was working for the United Nations, and that's how she and my father met. And so she had an interesting viewpoint of the Major and my grandmother. And I knew as a very young child, I was told that he had something to do with Superman. And I didn't know what he had to do with Superman. I just knew that there was some connection there. And at one point, my mother told me that he lost DC Comics. He signed away his rights for a trip to Bermuda. So,
wow.
Yeah. So at the same time, she also had a very high opinion of the Major. They used to talk a lot, and she really respected him and thought he was a lovely person, a gentleman, very intelligent. So I did grow up with that aspect of it, but it was not until I was an adult that I really got the full family history lore. And because I came into the family as an adult, I think my aunts, my dad, my aunts and my uncle and the Swedish cousins, they were all so excited and they wanted to tell me everything. So I ended up hearing a lot of the stories as an adult, not as a child. And my father, interestingly, had carried around, for 30 years, he had carried around this leather packet of letters and photographs. And he gave it to me the first time we met. And he said, I wanted you to know who you are. And I didn't realize until, I guess, 10 or 15 years later, how valuable that was. Because what he had done is taken out very specific letters, moments in my grandfather's life that were high points or low points, if you want to think of it that way. And so I ended up with this treasure trove of archival material.
Okay, so you're hearing the story about that he sold DC Comics for a trip to Bermuda, and we'll get into the details of, well, that's not correct or whatever, but we'll talk about that. But, like, was in your family, was there a sense of bitterness?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, because obviously as DC Comics became more and more, like, you know, when there was a Superman movie and all these things that were coming out, was it there was that kind of, like, oh, that kind of should have been our we should have been more involved in this. We could have been more involved in this.
Right. Yeah, there was a lot of bitterness, but it was also, it was kind of a schizophrenic sort of thing in the sense that there was a sense that it was my grandfather's fault in some way. And that, and at the same time, he had been, cheated, and on the other hand, so it was kind of this weird idea of the two different aspects. And part of that is because nobody really knew the facts. And when I started researching, because my background is as a writer myself, and I have a master's degree, so I went through that whole process of research and citing material, primary resource material. So I know all that stuff. And I worked in publishing for, 30 years. So I understand about research and facts. And when I started looking into my grandfather's story, my family had a lot of interesting family stories, but a lot of facts were missing.
So, okay. So, well, that's perfect. Perfect to lead into what I also wanted to ask. But, like, what inspired you to write this? I mean, what brought you to want to put together this massive book?
Well, I started researching in around 1997.
Wow. Okay.
And of course, I was working, and you know, in between other things. But I started seriously focusing on his life in 1997. And I always knew that I wanted to do a book or a movie script. I knew from the very beginning that I wanted to create something about his life, because the more I learned about it, the more phenomenal it was. And so when Gerard Jones' book came out, Men of Tomorrow, in 2004, my Auntie Diane, who was alive at the time and living in London, saw a review of it in Business Week. And the review picked up on the part in Jones' book where he described the major in this really crazy way. And my aunt just went bonkers, and she called me, because I was heavily into research at that point and sort of collecting everything from the family, and she was furious. And I said, okay, well, just calm down. Let me go get the book and let me see what he actually said. So I went to the local bookstore and got a copy and read it, and the next morning she calls me from London. Oh, darling, you're going to be so annoyed with me. And she had fired off this letter to the editor of Business Week, and he had passed it on to Jones's publisher, who got in touch with Auntie Diane, and she sent him to me. And he felt, all I did initially was send him a photograph of my grandfather. And he knew instantly, just from the photograph, that he had made a serious mistake.
Oh, how so? What does that mean?
Well, because he described my grandfather as this kook who was running around in some French cape. And, I mean, just really nutty. And I sent him a photograph of my grandfather in his fedora it was taken around 1948, very handsome, very distinguished looking man. And that told him right there that he had made a big mistake. So we started talking back and forth and back and forth. And he wanted to make up for that. So we met in 2008 when my grandfather was inducted into the Eisner Hall of Fame. And we talked about cooperating, collaborating on a book. And I agreed to do that. And we started in 2009. And it took forever. And I don't know if you know the story, but Gerard kind of blew his life up.
Yes, yes. He is, yeah. Yeah. For any of you, yeah.
So I was one of the pieces of collateral damage.
Oh, Lord.
Luckily, the book that we were working on never came to fruition because he just was not able to work on it. Mm. So I was left at the beginning of 2017, after almost 9 years of working on this book, and I had to do something. And I had been wanting to do a book of my grandfather's pulps and his comics, showing how the pulps were the foundation of the comics in a way. And so I talked to Dan Herman at Hermes Press had wanted to do something with me, and I talked to him about that. And then David Armstrong, do you know David?
I don't.
Well, you should interview him because he is amazing. And he knows just about everybody in comics, and he's an amazing historian. And he and I got to know one another that same year, 2008. And so he had a collection of early comics, and we started talking about it, and we figured out from, you know, what he had and the pulps that I had, what would work and what would fit together. And originally we were going to do the pulp story and the comic. And I realized at some point that was a terrible idea. And that what we needed to do was just the comics themselves with a shorter version of the Major's biography and about his time in the comics.
Okay. Now you never met the Major, right? Because died in 1966, correct?
Right.
Okay.
So the other thing I want to say is, on a personal note, that has a lot to do with it, I think. Because I grew up without my father, and I didn't have a real father figure in my life, other than my maternal grandfather, who was absolutely amazing and fabulous. And the more I learned about my grandfather, the Major, I just felt this incredible kinship with him, because I'm a writer, he was a writer, he was an incredibly creative person, and I think just on a personal basis, I just felt very connected to him, and I do feel very connected to him.
Yeah, well, that's something I wanted to ask you about as well, because it's sort of funny, this guy, in that I think in modern parlance, we would almost think of calling him like a Renaissance man, because he was into so many different things. I mean, he was obviously, he had a great appreciation for fiction and fantasy and the creative side of your brain and being creative. And yet he seemed like a real kind of adventure kind of guy, you know, like, I mean, he reminds me of the two. Are you familiar with the two men that directed King Kong, Ernest Chodzak?
Yeah.
Those guys, I mean, they had the imagination to make King Kong, and yet they also would put themselves in the way of like a tiger attack or go on ice floes. And these, I mean, there was the one guy, he was declared dead 3 times in his life. And at the same time, he created King Kong. And so I got that sort of feeling when reading about the Majors, that he was this kind of guy that was sort of this rough and tumble adventuresome kind of guy, very brave, and yet also really into like, you know, writing and the pulps. And I feel like you don't see a lot of guys like that nowadays.
No, he was one in a million. And that's why I feel so adamant and passionate about getting his story out there, because his story is bigger than anybody really completely comprehends. And he was an adventuresome person. And a lot of that is due, I think, to his mother, my great-grandmother, who was a suffragette. And he also, his father abandoned the family when he was about four, I think. Yeah, about 4 years old. And Antoinette, my great-grandmother, she ended up in Portland with her two boys. And she was a writer herself, a journalist. She was involved in the suffrage movement. And she was really an astounding, amazing person in her own right. And I think he was very influenced by her, just her sense of strength and just being out there. And not being afraid.
Right. Being a suffragette, she was no wallflower.
No.
So I think a lot of the people that are listening to this are probably similar to my age or maybe a little younger. And they, for them, I'm embedding the only real familiarity they have with Major Wheeler Nicholson is the – and really the only time I knew of him was the single page mention in a book – that DC put out in the mid-1980s called 50 Who Made DC Great, which was this little comic book they put out. And it was just a little self-bio about 50 people that were influential to DC Comics, Jeanette Kahn, Neil Adams, Dick Giordano, and Major Wheeler Nicholson is given a page in that. And that's the only time I can ever remember him being mentioned in any real prominent way in a DC comic. So for the people that are listening that have not read your book yet, and I, again, I encourage everybody to go to Amazon and go pick it up, why don't you explain to them a little bit, like, how he did that, like, who he was and how he ended up sort of founding the company in the first place?
Well, his career as an adult started in the military, and that was 1912. And he started out as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army in the cavalry. And he was first stationed on the Texas-Mexican border. Now, this is during that period when Pancho Villa the other two factions, it's complicated, and I don't know that history very well, but there were three basic factions during the Mexican Revolution. And at points, there were really like bandits involved. And there was a lot of back and forth across the border and stealing cattle and shooting American citizens. And, you know, it was very lawless in a way. So the army was sent down to that Mexican border, shades of history, right? To that Mexican border to keep order. And my grandfather was there on that Mexican border. So that was a pretty adventuresome beginning to his military career. And he had wanted from day one to be posted to the 9th Cavalry, which was the African-American Buffalo Soldiers. And he kept trying to get it, and they wouldn't give it to him because it was considered not a great posting for somebody who wanted to get ahead in the military. The African-American soldiers, the black soldiers, they could go as high as a sergeant, and then that was it. They were all, they had all white officers. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why my grandfather wanted to do it initially is because that's exactly what Pershing did. And that is how Pershing rose so quickly through the ranks, is by commanding Buffalo Soldiers and being an incredible officer and getting that attention. And I think my grandfather thought he could follow in Pershing's footsteps. So he finally got his posting to the 9th Cavalry, and he took his soldiers to the Philippines, which was at the end of the Moro War. Okay, so the Moros were the Muslim guerrillas, shades of history, in the Philippines. And by the way, that's still part of what goes on there. And so it was basically a mop-up situation then. So he takes these guys to the Philippines, and he sees firsthand the terrible prejudice that is that they deal with. And he decides to challenge his superior officer to machine gun readiness. So his white superior officer takes his white guys, my grandfather takes his black guys, and the end result is they beat the pants off of the white guys, and it was so amazing that it was written up in all these books and magazines, and the big brass was there. Well, that didn't go down too well. He was not too popular with his commanding officer after that, so he literally got sent to Siberia. He had friends in the military intelligence part, and so he ended up in Siberia during World War I, during the Bolshevik Revolution. And at one point, he supposedly was on the Tibetan-Mongolian-Chinese border in some secret mission. So he had a really adventuresome start.
Yes, my goodness.
And then after he was court-martialed, and I'm not going to go into that because it's a whole other story in itself, but read the book. Mm-hmm. And after that, when he got out of the army, he started writing for adventure magazines, pulp magazines, and he based a lot of his stories on his own adventures. And then after he met my grandmother, and they got married, she was Swedish, and they went to France in 1928, somewhere in there, and they were renting a chateau in Vic-sur-Aisne, just north of Paris, and they had a flat in Paris, and he was making really good money writing for the Faults. Well, the Depression hit, and the pay for word count for pulps went way down, so they had to come back to the United States, and like everybody else, they were facing real hardship. And for some unknown reason, he just thought it would be a great idea to do all original comics and start a whole new industry in the middle of the Depression.
Which is, you know, I mean, it's like akin to like saying, oh, hey, I have an idea, Facebook. I mean, it's like this, it's on that level. I mean, what an idea, what a random thing for him to come up with and have it be this thing now. It's amazing.
I know. It's really phenomenal. And people who have put him down have said things like, well, he did it because he couldn't get the rights to newspaper comics. Well, no, he had that idea from the very beginning. Maybe that had something to do with encouraging him to go ahead and do original comics, but the guy was a creator. So he wasn't about to do something that everybody else was doing. He wanted to stand out. And, you know, so he did.
Even if that had been the reason, that's still a good reason. I mean, even, you know, there's nothing wrong with saying, I have this idea. Oh, this, I can't do it the way we would normally do it. Oh, I have a new innovative way of doing it. That's like,
exactly.
I mean, my God, none of us would know each other if there was no comic book industry to kind of be a fan of. I mean, it's just, it's amazing at the level of like, just this notion of like, oh yeah, let's just do all new material. Let's just do that. Oh, well, hold on. That's never been done before. It's just amazing. So that is fantastic. Like, how did you've been talking about how you developed the book. Like, where did you go to find this material? Because something that I want to stress to people that have not seen the book, and there will be images from this book on our website, firewaterpodcast.com, because you all need to see some of the stuff. Not only is this book a history of the history of National Public National Periodic Publications and the Major, but it's also a collection of some of these strips in full. And I didn't know that going in, that there would be so much of this material. And it was amazing to see this stuff complete and in such beautiful form. Like, how did you go about even collecting this material? Where did you know to even, like, look for it?
Well, I have a very loyal group of guys, and they're all guys, and me. From the very beginning that I was introduced to the comics community in 2008, I have met some of the most amazing people that I just love so much, and they have been just incredible to me and supportive of me and encouraging me. And most of them are collectors. And David, that I mentioned, who helped with this book, he collaborated with me on the book. David Armstrong had the majority of those comics.
Really?
And yeah, that's why we were able to do it. And what he didn't have, he knew all the other collectors. And so Bud Plant's books.
Sure.
Bud had some, and then Alex Grand, who runs the Comic Book Historians Group, he had some. And then there were a couple of other guys, too, that I mentioned in the acknowledgments of the book. So what David didn't have, we were able to get from this, you know, really elite group of collectors. And they were absolutely fabulous, and I love them all to pieces.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. I mean, they had what? Like, they had just the comics themselves, or did they have?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They had the originals.
Wow. That's remarkable. I didn't know any of this stuff still existed anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. There are collectors out there who have some of these things, and they're very picky about it. But these guys, look how generous they have been to put this out there. And I owe them so much. A really great group of guys.
So what were your thoughts when you were looking at this material? Some of the strips I'm going to mention that are here in sort of long form, there's five strips in particular: Barry O'Neill and Fang Gao of China, Bob Merritt and his Flying Pals, Blood Pearls, The Monastery of the Blue God, and The Golden Dragon. The thing that I had not heard of any of these. I think maybe Barry O'Neill, but the rest were completely unknown to me. And one of the things that I was so impressed by, and I talked about this in the episode of Treasury Cast I did, talking about the new Fun book, was I'm so impressed at the level of artistry in strips, knowing when you know that these guys knew at the time how poor reproduction was, the technology at the time just was not very good. And the amount of detail in these strips is breathtaking, to know that these guys labored over these pages, knowing that probably so much of it was never going to be seen or not going to be seen the way that they intended. I mean, some of the stuff is just gorgeous.
I know. That's one of the things that really knocked me out was the artwork. And I talk about that in DC Comics Before Superman. I talk about the artwork and I talk about the artist, because you have to realize that they were used to, if they had been working on comic strips and newspapers, they were working in panels. And now, all of a sudden, especially when you look at Leo O'Malley's work on Bob Merritt, I mean, the Bob Merritt, some of those panels could be paintings by themselves. I mean, they're just drop-dead fabulous. And they also, the way some of the panels are positioned actually helps to tell the story. Mm-hmm. So they're moving, they're starting to experiment, and they're moving away from, you know, panel, 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 into now they have a page to work with. So there's a lot of innovation in those early comics that we now take for granted. And it's very important for people to understand where that came from. It didn't just drop out of the sky.
Right. Right. You can see that some of these guys clearly were starting to look at these pages as a unit. And you could structure the page in a way that would help – cohesive, put it more in a context as opposed to what you're talking about, which is just, all right, I'm going to draw panel one, draw panel two. No. I'm going to put this together in a way that the page itself is sort of a separate image when it's collected together as a whole piece. They're really beautiful.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing that I love is the different focus of each of the artists. For instance, Leo O'Malia, his focus tends to be what we would refer to as a long shot. So most of his panels are from a distance. You're seeing a whole thing, a whole picture, a whole scene. And then you get to Munson Paddock, and he was a photographer, and it shows because most of his artwork is right up close. Mm-hmm. So you're getting the close shots. And I just love all that. I think it's just amazing and fabulous. And I especially feel like, besides my grandfather, I want people to know about these early innovators in comics. They deserve to be known.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a page in Bob Merritt where a character is handing someone else hands Bob Merritt a note, a handwritten note, and then the next panel is just the note in cursive. Like you're just looking at the note itself. It's not. There's no drawing of somebody holding the note. It's just the note. Now, of course, in 2020. That doesn't sound like that much of an innovation, but you think about how much that is changing the form of what people are used to in
right.
comics. And I mean, that reminds me of that old story about one of the early Silence by D.W. Griffith, where he shot a thing of a train coming at the viewers, and people literally jumped out of the way because they thought they were going to be hit by a train.
Right,
you know,
right.
They just didn't have the mindset of like, oh, wait a minute, this is just a flat image. They really thought there was a train coming at them. And this, like, just that, just even something as small as that of not giving you context for this note and just making the note be the panel itself, it forces you to orient yourself, your mind in a way, you're reading something in a way you probably would not have read before. And not to say that there weren't some beautiful strips out there. Obviously, like Winsor McKay was amazing when he was doing comic strips, and George Harriman and things like that. But the idea, again, combining new material with this in a comic book form was, again, an amazing innovation. And it's, again, coming from a guy who kind of just did it, it's sort of like, why not try this? Let's try and do this. And how did he – like, where did he put together the money to do all this?
Oh, wow. Well, therein lies a tale. also, I want to say something about him as an editor. When I was researching his life, I went to the school that he went to, which had been a feeder school for the U.S. Army. And the archivist there found his one of his yearbooks, and he was an artist. So when he was in college, he was drawing and was considered an artist, and a lot of his drawings were all through this yearbook. So he already had that sense of the visual, and I can't say for certain, but I'm pretty sure that knowing my grandfather the way I know him, that he would have had some input in how things looked.
Right, so he had an appreciation for that aesthetic.
Now, I forgot your question.
it's one thing to have the idea. It's another thing to be able to just put it together. I mean, where did he get the resources and the people to collaborate with him to do all this?
Well, initially, he went to a couple of people that he had known for a long time, and I'm not going to say why because that's going into my big book about him. So I'm holding a few things back. But he went to some people that he had known for a long time who had money, and they provided him with the startup capital. Part of the problem, and one of the things that happened, you know, with him losing the company, is that not very many people did have a lot of capital. This was the Depression.
This is the Depression, yeah.
So, you know, instead of just doing one little comics comic book magazine. He knew that in order to make money, he had to follow the pulp publishing template, which was, in order to make money, he needed to have 4 or 5, 6, 7 titles, different. Sorry, my cat just jumped on my desk.
Cats will do that.
Sorry. He knew that he was going to have, you know, more than one magazine. So within a 3-year period, a little over 3 years, the guy put out, he created 4 different magazines. And out of those magazines, he did something like 80-something separate, you know, comics magazines in under each title. I mean, that's a lot.
That's a Herculean load of work.
Yeah. And that's like if you started The New Yorker and then you started New York Magazine and then you started Newsweek within 3 years. Mm-hmm. And put out, you know, put out a magazine every month.
Right.
That's a hell of a lot.
And with the technology at the time. I mean, yeah. You know, on top of it, that would be hard enough to do now.
So, no surprise, he ran out of money. And in order to keep up that level. And who had money then? Well, besides a few wealthy people, the people who had money were the bootleggers and the gangsters, and they needed places to launder that money. And so he got involved with Harry Donenfeld and Jack Leibowitz.
Explain to the listeners who those people are in case people don't know.
Well, I kind of like Harry Donenfeld, although one of his granddaughters has come out with a book recently that refers to him as a lovable huckster. Okay. I would dispute that, but I do have a regard for his huckstering. Harry Donenfeld came out of the Lower East Side. He his family was originally from Russia, and they were refugees. And, you know, he had to scrap out of there. So you got to give him a lot of credit. And he was just one of those guys who knew how to bank a buck, and he got involved with people who were making money in all sorts of other ways during the Prohibition. And that's how he made a lot of money. And so he had money. He was a printer at that time, and he had a history of taking over magazines and in his own inimitable fashion. And either the people became silent partners or he kicked them out. Hmm. And Jack was more of an accountant, but I think he was much harder. Harry Donenfeld's grandson, who was also named Harry Donenfeld, told me that Jack Leibowitz was known as the eraser. And when he got rid of you, he erased you. And that's essentially what happened to the major, is he was just erased from DC history, basically.
Well, right. I mean, explain that to people who don't know, because I mean, obviously he did not, the major did not sell DC Comics for a trip to Bermuda.
No, he did not. What I can tell from all the information I have a lot of legal documents, many documents that he was forced to sign, slowly giving over his rights to Harry Donenfeld and Jack Leibowitz, and in exchange for being able to pay everybody. So in other words, they had the money and they would say, okay, we're going to give you this money to pay everybody, but you need to sign this piece of paper. And, you know, he didn't want people to go without money. So he slowly, slowly, you know, got pushed into a corner, and then they filed a forced bankruptcy at the end of 1937. And a forced bankruptcy is different from a person going bankrupt or a business going bankrupt. It means that your creditors force you into bankruptcy. So he was being forced into bankruptcy by his own partners. And they ended up getting his destroying his publishing company. And the mystery is his publishing company was called, at that point, was called Nicholson Publishing, Inc., and it held the titles to New Fun, More Fun, Adventure, but he was co-owner with Jack Leibowitz in DC Comics, and that was not part of the bankruptcy. So the question remains, how did he get pushed out of DC Comics? There is no paperwork. There is Michael Uslan said that he saw a check written to the major for the amount of money that he supposedly owed to Harry Donenfeld. So we're surmising, Michael and I have surmised, that what happened is they said, okay, here's how much money you owe us. We'll write you a check for that, and then you have to sell your share of DC. So that's how he lost it, we think. We're pretty sure. Michael's a very astute comics history scholar. So.
I mean, and to provide context for people, I mean, all this is happening 1 year before Superman. I mean, you know, I mean, it's like all this hugger mugger is happening, and yet
it was sooner than that. It was closer than that.
Right, because Superman was lying around at that point.
Well, this is where all the different stories are floating out there. There are a number of stories, and I've talked at length with Laura Siegel, Jerry Siegel's daughter. And what happened is that in December of 1937, Jack Leibowitz contacted Jerry Siegel and was doing a deal with him behind the major's back. So they were already planning to take over the company. Now, Action Comics came out in April of 1938.
Right.
And so the major says in his court deposition for the bankruptcy, he says they were working 3 to 4 months ahead. So if you count back, you're talking December-ish. And he is the person who filed the trademark for Action Comics.
Oh, okay.
And the family story is that he was planning Superman for Action Comics, but there is no written proof of that. That is only a family story. So I cannot unequivocally say that is, you know, a fact. I can only say that that is what I have heard from all my aunts and uncle, my dad.
One of the myths that you sort of dispel in the book, which I thought was interesting, is that because the story that I'd always heard was that Superman as a concept was sort of lying around in slush piles, that nobody wanted it. And that it was finally, you know, this one poor editor decided, oh, let's give it a shot. But that wasn't the case at all. That it was not regarded as, oh, what is this thing? It was actually considered, oh, wait, this seems like a good idea.
Well, my grandfather was the first, as far as I know, was the first publisher to see that initial crude drawing of Superman. Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster sent him a bunch of material in April of 1935. And that was one of the things in the material that they sent him. And he was very impressed with their, with what they sent. They sent, among the things they sent was the Henri Duval, and which was sort of like a Douglas Fairbanks action comic. And, I just went blank. I'll think of it in a second.
They had Dr. Occult.
So my grandfather took both of the. Oh, yeah, Dr. Occult. Thank you. And so my grandfather took both of those comics and he hired them. And they appeared for the first time in what we now think of as DC Comics in October of 1935, working for my grandfather. Hmm. He hired them. And he was the person who saw the Superman drawing. And years later, Jerry Siegel said in an anniversary edition of Batman, in a letters column in the back, he said that, you know, if the major had not, you know, had thrown those things out in the trash, you know, they might not have ever broken into comics. Oh. And I give Jerry Siegel a lot of credit. He was really young, and he knew about my grandfather from the pulps because he loved the pulps and knew about the pulps. And he, I think he was really smart to send my grandfather that Henri Duval, because he knew that my grandfather had written Swashbucklers, so that it would naturally appeal to my grandfather. That's very smart. That's a very clever thing to do.
That leads perfectly into something else I wanted to ask you about. And I know this is going to require a certain amount of speculation from you about someone that you never met, but you talked about how you feel like you got to know the major through the research on this book. Do you feel as though that he would have been, had he stayed at DC Comics, had he not been sort of pushed out, do you think he would have been he would have recognized, and maybe the answer is already here because we talk about that he hired Siegel and Schuster, that he would have recognized that superheroes were going to become the dominant the dominant genre in the comic medium. I mean, obviously comics would go on to do war and Western and humor and stuff like that, but he was doing comics just before Superman, and then everything became superheroes to a certain extent. And for a long time, superheroes and comic books became synonymous, that it was, to a lot of people, that's what comic books mean, or superheroes, which is, of course, not the case. Do you think he would have been appreciated, for someone who didn't grow up with superheroes, like, obviously he didn't, because there weren't such things, do you think he would have been able to see the market value of Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman, The Flash, all these characters that eventually took off?
I'm absolutely certain of that, because he championed Superman. He tried to encourage, there are letters from him to Jerry Siegel in which he is encouraging them to do the Superman comic as having its own comic and doing it in four colors. He was the first publisher to promote that idea. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Absolutely. He recognized right off the bat what an incredible character that was, you know, that Superman was. You have to remember, this is like pre-World War II, when things in Europe are getting kind of gnarly there, and he had knowledge of that. His military experience in Europe and in the Far East, he was very cognizant of what was going on. And he was also an intellectual and read a lot, and I am almost positive that he would have encouraged that. One thing that people have asked me is, would I think that, you know, DC would have survived financially? And I think it would have had a different track. I think it would have been more like Marvel in the sense of being much more personal and much more creator involved.
Okay.
And not such a cold corporate entity.
Okay. That's an interesting observation. I can remember when I was a kid and I took a tour of the Marvel offices, and this is in the 80s too. I mean, but I took a tour, and I remember thinking it felt like a big clubhouse. You know what I mean? That was the mentality. And yet the rep on DC was that it was much more, a lot quieter, you know, a lot more rigid and locked down. So I could sort of see that. I mean, from your research that you did on the book, was how did he handle it through the rest of his life? I mean, was that something that was a perennial sore spot until the day he died, that he felt like that he'd been pushed out, and as he saw DC become this big thing, or did he was he able to kind of adjust to it and say, well, okay, that's something from his life, but it didn't sort of like consume him?
initially he was devastated, and I mean, he took it very, very hard. There are family stories that he, you know, went on sort of a drinking spree and threatened to join the Black Watch, which is like the French Foreign Legion in Scotland. You know, it was like that sort of drama going on. So, yeah, he took it very hard. And then he refused to talk about it ever again.
Wow.
Which is why the family stories were so kind of not accurate, because they knew my father was around, I think, 10, 11. My aunt, Tony, the eldest, she was around 13, 14. So she remembered more of that period. And they remember what happened then, but afterwards, there was no discussion of it. So there was no real factual follow through. And he, being the kind of person he was, he just eventually pulled himself together, and he went back to writing for adventure stories. He wrote pulps until 1956. And he also, during World War II, he wrote three nonfiction books that were well-received. He wrote articles in Life and Look and Harper's Magazine, and he was very well-respected for his political and military understanding of strategy. And so he had a completely, you know, new career. And then after the war, he went to Sweden in 1948, and he discovered these formulas for industrial paint, and he bought them, and he came back to the States with them. And my cousin Tony remembers, as a young child, of him in the kitchen of my grandparents' house cooking up these formulas, and she said it was like something out of a comic book, because things would blow up and smoke would go everywhere. So he was really phenomenal. I mean, at the end of his life, here he was trying out these industrial formulas. And so, you know, he went on to do other things in his life, and he wrote every day of his life.
Some people just have that engine in them. You know, it's amazing. Some people just want to constantly be trying new things or innovating, and, you know, trying this or trying that. That's just remarkable.
Yeah.
All right. So changing tracks slightly, the other big event of this year regarding the major was the big reprint of New Fun Comics number one, the famous first edition, which, again, I've mentioned already, and we covered over on Treasury Cast. I know you have an essay in that. I mean, can you explain to people how you were involved in getting that out?
Well, if it weren't for me, it wouldn't have happened.
there you go. So you had a lot to do with it.
Statistically. But it's true. As I mentioned, I have this group of guys who are just amazing, loyal, my posse. And there's a group on Facebook for the major. And one of the guys on there, who there are a number of really you know, high collectors, and they're historians, and, you know, all kinds of really, you know, knowledgeable people on that group. So one of the guys sent me a message and said, you got to go check out this collector site. So I went on the site, and there was a rare copy of New Fun number one for sale for $12,500, which I do not have. And so I went on my group and I said, guys, we got to do something. This is for sale. And I said, I'm looking at you, DC Comics. And there are people from DC on that group. And there was some back and forth. And you know, we don't have the money. It's not in our budget, blah, blah, blah. And I said,
oh, come on, guys.
And so I just started my little campaign with some of the executives who have gotten to know me, and not always happily. And I started a campaign, and I said, you guys have got to buy this for the archives. Otherwise, it's just going to go to some collector, and we're never going to see it again.
Right.
And so they did have one copy of New Fun, number one, but it wasn't in good shape.
No.
And this was in excellent condition. So they bought it. I couldn't believe they listened to me. They bought it. And I went in, I think it was March of 2019. I think I went to Burbank to the archives, and I got to hold it in my hands, and wow. I cried, and you know, it was really emotional because it just felt like the Holy Grail.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is.
And then one of the guys in my group said, you need to check this out. And it turned out that DC had decided to reprint it. And they didn't tell me. And they should have told me. So my guys started a little bit of a social media commentary about how I needed to be involved. And so there were lots of apologies. And, oh, we meant to involve you. Yeah, right. Anyway, being me, I just, you know, went in there with gangbusters, and Benjamin LeClaire, who is the archivist at DC, and he deserves a crown for putting up with my aggressive, passionate agenda and having to, you know, deal with his bosses. And we just worked back and forth and back and forth, and they did a phenomenal job at DC. It is beautiful. I could not be happier. I mean, it's just... It's just wonderful. And so, of course, I wrote the essay about my grandfather, and I insisted that the contributors, short bios of the contributors, be included. Mm-hmm. So I wrote those as well.
Oh, you wrote the bios. I didn't know that.
Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I wrote all the bios.
Yeah. It's a gorgeous book. I mentioned it on the episode. It's just a beautiful piece of not just DC of comic book history, and they did such a great job on it. I'm so glad that they did it, because you can imagine it probably doesn't have a whole lot of commercial appeal necessarily, because these are all characters and strips that nobody's really heard of anymore. Again, this is pre-Superman stuff, but just as a historical artifact, I was so impressed with that. When I got my copy, I thought, oh, this was worth every dime that they charged for this.
Yeah. Well, Benjamin LeClaire deserves a lot of credit for that. He did a superb job editing it, and he was just wonderful. And he put up with me, so twice as wonderful. Yeah, and the problem is that I begged them to do some PR, and I was willing to do just about anything to promote it. But, you know...
Like, talk to me.
Yeah, you know, ATT, they could care less. It's not worth $1 million, so they're not interested. So that was kind of disappointing to me, because that book came out. This year is the 85th anniversary of DC Comics.
Right.
And it's the 85th anniversary of New Fun number one. And it also happens to be the 130th anniversary of my grandfather's birth.
Wow.
I just felt like they should have done a little more, but they didn't. That's the way it goes. So... Well, I'm doing as much as I can.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of the reason that I wanted to do this with you and talk about your book, is because when I did the episode of Treasury Cast about New Fun, the dominant theme in all the comments we got and from emails I got was, I didn't know this book was out. I didn't know this was a thing. So I was like, well, great. We're doing a service here. We're letting people know that you can go to Amazon or go to InStock Trades or go to wherever and buy this thing, because it is beautiful. So a couple other things I want to ask before we wrap up here. First of all, like, do you have a particular – of all the stuff that you went through for both the new – you know, the stuff you saw in New Fun and then the stuff for DC Before Superman, do you have a particular favorite? I mean, is there something that just really tickled your fancy in terms of the strips? And the other thing I would ask you is, we didn't talk about yet, are you a comic book fan? Is this – I mean, this is in your blood, but did you grow up with this
material? Yeah, totally. I'm a total comic book fan, but I'm not like, you know – male comic book fans. I'm a female comic book fan, so I never collected.
Right. Okay.
So I didn't get into that part of it. But I was a comics fan from the time I was a little kid. When the Sunday papers came out, woe be unto anyone who got to the comics before me. And, you know, I bought comics from the corner drugstore, you know, Spinner, and I followed, you know, the comics during college. And, you know, I've always been a comics fan. So I just didn't collect. So a lot of guys don't take you seriously if you don't collect. So, yeah, I'm a comics fan. So, and the comic that I am most, well, there are two. One is Slam Bradley, but the one that I am very focused on and am working on doing a project about is Sandra of the Secret Service.
Oh, right. Okay.
And for anybody who has gotten New Fun number one reprint, when you open it up, that is the first comic. And you have to understand that that comic has primary real estate in that magazine. Pretty unusual for the time. Here is a woman character who's the hero, and her comic is the very first one in a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty phenomenal.
So that was one of your favorites?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, superb. Well, so the last thing I want to ask you before we sign off here is, like, ultimately, what do you hope people would take away from this book, from this massive labor that you put together, and you find the book's finally out, and now you said you're working on something else? Like, what ultimately do you want people to take away from DC Comics Before Superman?
Well, I think the most important thing I want people to take away is understanding my grandfather's influence on modern comics and how important it is, and that there is a through line from that beginning New Fun number one all the way into modern comics. A lot of the people that started in the beginning were in comics throughout their entire careers. And also, I think the other important thing is the incredible creativity that is part of that period. This was the Depression. All these artists suddenly had work. And, you know, they might not have been paid much or sometimes not paid at all, but it was happening. And there was an explosion of creativity in this period in a new medium, a new industry. And it must have been really exciting. And those are the things I especially want people to take away. And also just that my grandfather was a phenomenal person. A very good man with a really strong code behavior who lived an adventurous life.
Well, like I said, as someone who read the book, I would say that you accomplished that mission, because, like I said, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I learned a lot of new things, which is always great, because I love the history of the medium, and this was like a vital piece of it. So I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I really appreciated you stopping by to talk with me about it. I hope anyone that's listening to this that doesn't know that the book was out there, you can go get it on various places, at Amazon, of course, and other places, and you can read reviews of it on Goodreads and things like that. It is well worth your time. So anybody interested in the history of comics, or just reading some classic pulp strips in the most beautiful form possible, check this book out. So again, thank you so much for coming on and talking with me, Nikki. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, Rob. And I would just say that as an advertisement, that people can find me on social media, and also they can find the Major on Twitter and Instagram at MWNTheMajor. And so thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
Oh, no problem at all. So again, yeah, I was going to ask you what your social media thing is, but you already did it, so that's great. So, of course, everybody go follow Nikki over on Twitter, and she's on Facebook and stuff like that. And go take a look at this book, and you will, as I mentioned, you will see images from it on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. The publisher was nice enough to provide us with a PDF copy of it, so we have some nice, beautiful images from the book, and you'll be able to check out the book a little bit on the website. So that is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And like I said, go check out DC Comics Before Superman, and we will see you later. Bye-bye.
Hello, I'm Jack Ryder, here in the outer offices of DC Comics, where a party is underway kicking off DC's golden year anniversary celebration. DC, the place where legends live.